This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to speak about the work of Pierre Klosowski, who I'm already delighted to find out that at least two in the audience know already. His work is not well known in the United States. Many of you may know his work on Nietzsche and the Vicious Circle, that was just published in English a couple of years ago in a translation by Dan Smith, or his study of Sade entitled Sade Mon Prochain, Sade My Neighbor. In France, the name of Klosowski is really indissociable from that of Nietzsche. Michel Foucault described his book on Nietzsche as the greatest work of philosophy I have ever read, with Nietzsche himself. And he was really behind, from, say, the 1930s onward, the important renewal of interest in the work of Nietzsche, and fueled most famously the work of Deleuze and Guattari, but also that of Foucault, Lacan, and other figures. However, he is also a writer of fiction. His fiction is less known than his critical writing, I think, in France as well as in the U.S. In the U.S., it's really not known at all. And part of what I want to discuss today is the interest of his fiction for critical theory and for philosophy in particular. His fiction has only been sporadically published in English, typically by small presses dealing with perverse erotica or softcore porn. When his brilliant 1965 trilogy, The Laws of Hospitality, was partially translated in English under the title Robert ce soir and the Revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which unfortunately loses the reference to hospitality. Its Library of Congress classification characterized it simply as erotic fiction, French. So to the extent that his fiction is known, it tends to be both in France and in the United States as the very emblem of perversion. Okay. His artwork graces the cover of Serge André's psychoanalytic study, L'Imposture Perverse, and of numerous erotic novels. He's been diagnosed as a pervert by writers on both sides of the Atlantic, and hailed by unironic readers of his Sade Mon Prochain as Sade's disciple and heir. Many also know that he was the author chosen to replace Jacques Lacan when the latter's Conte avec Sade was deemed unsuitable as an introduction to Pauvert's edition of the Marquis de Sade's Oeuvre Complète, and that his work inspired two of the greatest counter-psychoanalytic works of the 1970s, Deleuze and Guattari's Anti-Oedipus and Lyotard's Libidinal Economy. But the philosophical and psychoanalytic stakes of his erotic fiction have never been systematically explored. Admittedly, the larger stakes of his work are easily obscured by its free adaptation of the stock themes of libertine literature. His fictional works, like his visual compositions, which are essentially kind of drawings of rape scenes, often on historical themes, say the rape of Lucretia, the legend of Diana and Actaeon. Each of these explore the conflict between a woman's chaste moral attitude and her gradual surrender to an assailant's advances. The Laws of Hospitality concerns the erotic awakening of hospitality in a woman that exposes a contradiction within her moral character and reveals her symbolic identity to be without foundation. Its protagonist, Octave, who bears more than a passing resemblance to his creator, is a collector of artworks that eroticize the moment of moral hesitation experienced by women submitting to the sexual advances of a chance stranger, or even a spiritual apparition. His Laws of Hospitality are the fruit of his desire to experience this operation firsthand. They name a practice wherein the master of the house offers his wife to fortuitous guests in order to savor the moment of her surrender. But to the extent that Klosowski's work is perverse, it must be taken seriously for everything that this designation implies. As in the great manifestos of perversion, Klosowski proceeds implacably towards the demonstration of a thesis concerning the status of the signifier or law. But what this preeminent reader of Nietzsche demonstrates is the unfoundedness of the law of personal identity by virtue of the death of God. What is at stake in Klosowski's perverse meditations is something very different from the Sadean project of a brooding religious morality. Sade challenges the patriarchal and religious authorities of his day by demonstrating that the paternal signifier on which their laws are based is without foundation. In proving that the law cannot hold up against the repeated assaults of libertinage, he seeks to mount a systematic deconstruction of the symbolic order of language by the real of jouissance. But although Klosowski may share what Willy Apollon has described as the perverse drive to, quote, humiliate the law with the object, his target is not the signifier as such, but rather the imaginary consistency afforded by what he calls the grammatical fiction of the I, the illusion of autonomous personhood. The object with which he confronts it is not the natural truth of jouissance, but rather the feminine object who disrupts the identity of the master who offers her. Klossowski's reflections on the special status of femininity in Enlightenment culture, at once marginal and singularly extimate, have never been fully appreciated, despite their enormous interest for the study of culture. In a way unique among contemporary authors, Klossowski sheds light on Jacques Lacan's enigmatic insight that the cultural importance of the feminine object consists in its sublimated status as an object raised to the dignity of the thing. His fiction underscores the close ties between the feminine and what Freud called das Ding, the thing uncannily internal to subjectivity that Lacan later identified with the function of the Nebenmensch as the very apotheosis of the Christian idea of the prochain or neighbor. Although Klossowski's erotic scenario invites comparison with Sade's and Fourier's utopian calls to dissolve the privative boundaries between subjects, what he understands by hospitality is not the abolition of personal identity, but rather the staging of its internal contradiction. And despite some of the indications that I've given here, I'm unfortunately not going to speak very much about Lacan and or Sade, although the larger version of this project does so. So maybe that's something that we could take up in discussion later if you're interested. The act of hospitality, whose theological and philosophical origins this former Dominican novice and Latin scholar was intimately acquainted with, concerns a very particular tension. Etymologically, the host is the master, the one who eminently personifies identity, not only his own identity, but also that of the group in whose name he acts. But at the same time, the host's identity is paradoxically established through the dispossession and surrendering of his substance, evident in the traditional wisdom that the best host is the one who is given the most, even to the point of giving away that which defines him as master and host. This tension identifies an aporetic limit where identity is established at the very moment of its dissolution through contact with the non-identical, the other. In the Western tradition, this tension is embodied by the patriarch Abraham. In his wake, the biblical injunction to, quote, make the stranger native among you, from Leviticus 19, inaugurates a relation to subjectivity defined by nomadism and estrangement, where strangeness is figured as something native or uncannily intimate to subjectivity. The choice of a religious figure to represent this dialectic of hospitality is not incidental, for if the host submits to this dispossession of his identity, it is, in almost every hospitality tradition, because of the implied promise that his identity will also be realized through this act. Hospitality becomes a uniquely religious relation, a sacred act that mandates this extreme exposure and dispossession on the part of the host, but also allows this dispossession to be successfully endured and even valorized. In the ancient Greek, Jewish, and Christian traditions, the principal divinity, Zeus, Yahweh, or the Holy Trinity, incarnates hospitality and evaluates the character of human hosts by appealing for hospitality disguised as a supplicant. Accordingly, the host both does and does not know the identity of his divine guest. Hospitality is motivated by the potentially sacred nature of the guest, whose true identity must nonetheless remain unknown for authentic hospitality to take place. As the absolute unknowable other, God represents an alterity that is affirmatively construed, since man's relation to the divine allows for identity to be realized in its dispossession, actualized by the divine stranger. Were the guest not potentially divine, or at least an occasion to gain recognition by the divine, the stranger would simply annihilate and not realize his host's identity. But these traditional formulations beg certain questions implied in Klossowski's idiosyncratic take on hospitality. What meaning or relevance, for example, would hospitality have outside of a sacred or religious context? If God in his unknown quality is the ultimate guest, the stranger inassimilable in his difference, then how in the absence of religion can we imagine, much less practice, the radical opening up of identity that the ethics of hospitality demands? The modern era has toyed with at least two different alternatives, neither of which is wholly satisfactory. The first replaces the absolute ethics of hospitality with formalizable laws, which absorb the stranger's foreignness under a common measure, such as a legal designation, national identity, ethnic or community membership, or a principle of economic exchange, as in the most modern avatar of the hospitality relation, the so-called hospitality industry of tourism. Such solutions erase the fundamental inequality between host and guest, rendering them interchangeable, reversible positions that may even be designated by the same term. In many languages, you have this in French, l'hôte, l'hôte. In German, you have that same sort of parallel. The limitation of these models is that the increasing secularization of human relations has potentially left no place for the other to be considered as sacred in its unknowability, and at the same time provided no compelling new reason for the host to accept the dispossession of identity that hospitality implies. Moreover, the problem is larger than just secularization. Christian Eucharistic hospitality, which is the doctrinal name for the practice of communion, is the transubstantive equivalent of the secular reciprocity, since it allows for the faithful to be made equal as values of the one Christ by their consumption of the host. The estrangement that characterizes Hebraic hospitality is redeemed in the brotherhood of Christ, which makes men neighbors at the expense of disavowing or even demonizing their strangeness. The Marquis de Sade suggested a second alternative, which is less the apotheosis than the repressed underside of the first, the complete eraser of the private of boundaries between subjects enacted through the imperative of universal adulteration, as in La Philosophie dans le Boudoir. Upholding a universal law of jouissance at the expense of legal identities or moral codes, Sade seeks to erase the borders not only between nations, but between the sexes, between the self and the other, and between the human subject and the jouissance precluded by the law. But in the process, Sade does not so much revive the stakes of hospitality as disavow what is most fundamental to it, the encounter with the other as the internal limit of the subject's own identity. Klosowski's formulation of hospitality doesn't accept either alternative. Instead, he invents a third way, inspired by the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche and his doctrine of the eternal return. Whereas these first two responses dispense with the unknowability of the other in getting rid of God, Nietzsche implies that it is not the sacred determination of the hospitality act that is outdated, but rather the way in which the person of the stranger has increasingly been inscribed within categorical determinations. To the Judeo-Christian imperative to love the neighbor, Nietzsche opposes a love of the most distant man or man of the future, but also the foreign or the unfamiliar, more generally speaking. Whereas post-Enlightenment hospitality merely substitutes secular principles for religious values, the Nietzschean death of God entails the annihilation of all principles, the transvaluation of all values, including the value of personal identity itself. In his philosophical writings, Klosowski stresses that the logical conclusion we must draw from Nietzsche's argument is that for the transvaluation of all values to be complete, identity itself must disappear along with God. His thesis really involves the end of the positive idea of personal identity that the monotheist understanding of God perpetuates. But while Nietzsche is critical of the notion of identity upon which a certain understanding of hospitality is predicated, it is important for Klosowski's purposes that he does not dismiss the importance of hospitality altogether. In reworking the topoi of the stranger, the wanderer, and the uncanny, Nietzsche demonstrates that the hospitality relation is where the transvaluation of all values will take place, making way for the possibility of a non-identical, dissolved subjectivity. In its imminence, hospitality sketches the horizon of a modernity that can no longer appeal to a transcendental representation of identity. Its dominant figure is the eternal return of the same as different as dispossessed of its identity to itself. Despite its apparent archaism, therefore, hospitality reemerges as an essential concern for modernity, presenting a unique challenge to metaphysical notions of identity. But although Klosowski is indebted to Nietzsche, his own conception of hospitality breaks new ground by elaborating these problems within the domain of the sexual relation. In his fictional trilogy, The Laws of Hospitality, he departs from the explicitly philosophical orientation of his earlier work to engage the relationship between a man and wife and the peculiar laws of hospitality that govern their marriage. The hostess is the key term in a hospitable relationship whose purpose is the actualization of the inactual essences of the host, hostess, and guest at the expense of their privative identities. And you probably hear in this an echo of a kind of a theological language, which Klosowski is going to engage very much in the passage that I'll look at you with you in a moment. Although the feminine traditionally occupies an essential position within the hospitality relation, it is generally not as a subject. In each of the religious traditions informing Klosowski's work, as well as in archaic practice, the host is always male, and even the many terms designating the host have no female equivalent. By making the hostess the centerpiece of his conception of hospitality, Klosowski departs from the familiar contours of the hospitality tradition, and at the same time recovers something latent within that tradition from its archaic origins, which has been largely suppressed and overlooked in its dominant institutional forms. even as archaic forms of hospitality and exchange were replaced by modern secular relations, such as brotherly love, equal rights, legal citizenship, the feminine continues to occupy a marginal and uncertain position. Klossowski's insistence upon the hostess challenges these models with evidence of their limitations, but it does so not simply by giving her equal importance, allowing her to take her place alongside the men. Rather, women contest the reversibility of an equal relation to the other with evidence of the fundamental inequality with regard to the signifier that defines the sexual relation. She exceeds the economy of exchange, having no place in the reciprocal relation established between male host and male guest. Paradoxically enough, however, Klossowski's critique is played out through the offering of a woman between men. His protagonist, Octave, is a retired professor of scholastic theology. He wants to experience the divine in a post-divine world, and he hopes to apprehend it by provoking a certain excess in his wife, Roberte, an unknown that eludes the conjugal gaze. An unlikely match for her husband, Roberte is in many ways the supreme achievement of Enlightenment ideals, the very cliché of the emancipated woman. A severe beauty who is both a high-ranking member of the Chamber of Deputies and president of the Commission for Censorship. Roberte is a real Virginia Slims kind of girl, a feminist avant la lettre. She's really the last person we would expect to see involved in such an intrigue, which is part of the point. For Octave suspects that there is something more to her, which he hopes to discover with the help of chance strangers. In the opening pages of Robert Ce Soir, the central novel in Klossowski's trilogy, Octave's nephew describes his uncle's laws of hospitality as follows. When my uncle Octave took my aunt Robert in his arms, one must not suppose that in taking her, he was alone. An invited guest would enter while Robert, entirely given over to my uncle's presence, was not expecting him. And while she was in fear lest the guest arrive, for with irresistible resolution, Robert awaited the arrival of some guest, the guest would already be looming up behind her as my uncle made his entry, just in time to surprise my aunt's satisfied fright at being surprised by the guest. But in my uncle's mind, it was all over and done with in the blink of an eye, and once again my uncle would be on the point of taking my aunt in his arms. It would be over in the blink of an eye, for, after all, one cannot at the same time take and not take, be there and not be there, enter a room when one is already in it. My uncle Octave would have been asking too much had he wished to prolong the instant of the open door. He was already doing exceedingly well in getting the guest to appear in the doorway at the precise moment he did, getting the guest to loom up behind Robert so that he, Octave, might be able to sense that he himself was the guest as, borrowing from the guest his door-opening gesture, he could behold them from the threshold and have the impression that it was he, Octave, who was taking my aunt by surprise. Admittedly, it isn't necessarily clear why this scenario would represent a compelling alternative to Christianity or even to tourism. But as the novel unfolds, Klossowski reveals that the erotic awakening of the woman suspended between host and guest does nothing less than assume the place vacated by God in maintaining the tension between identity and its dispossession. The laws of hospitality that Octave conceives and in which his wife participates are elaborated in an extremely dense and cryptic argument whose handwritten pages are framed under glass and hung appropriately enough in the guest bedroom. And this is the text I've given you called The Laws of Hospitality on the first page of that sheet. And this is slightly abridged from the way that it appears in Klossowski's text. I've eliminated about a paragraph worth to make it a bit shorter. The master of this house, maître de séance, and I'll talk about the significance of the French formulation later, having no greater nor more pressing concern than to shed the warmth of his joy at evening upon whomever comes to dine at his table and to rest under his roof from a day's wearying travel, waits anxiously at the gate for the stranger he will see appear like a liberator upon the horizon. And catching a first glimpse of him, though he be still far off, the master will call out to him, "Come in quickly, I'm afraid of my happiness." For with the stranger he welcomes, the master of the house seeks a relationship that is no longer accidental, but essential. At the start, the two are but isolated substances. Between them there is none but accidental communication. You who believe yourself far from home, in the home of someone you believe to be at home, you bring merely the accidents of your substance, such accidents conspire to make a stranger of you, to him who bids you avail yourself of all that makes a merely accidental host of him. But because the master of this house herewith invites the stranger to penetrate to the source of all substances beyond the realm of all accident, This is how he inaugurates a substantial relationship between himself and the stranger, which will be not a relative relationship, but an absolute one, as though the master becoming one with the stranger, his relationship with you who have just set foot here, were now but a relationship of one with oneself. To this end, the host actualizes himself in the guest, or, if you prefer, he actualizes a possibility of the guest, just as you, the guest, actualize a possibility of the host. The host's most eminent gratification has for its object the actualization in the mistress of the home, la maîtresse de séance, of the inactual essence of the hostess. Now, upon whom is this duty incumbent, if not the guest? Does this mean that the master of the house expects betrayal at the hands of the mistress of the house? Now, it seems that the essence of the hostess, such as the host visualizes it, would in this sense be undetermined and contradictory. For either the essence of the hostess is constituted by her fidelity to the host, and in this case she eludes him the more he wishes to know her in the opposite state of betrayal, for she would be unable to betray him in order to be faithful to him, or else the essence of the hostess is really constituted by infidelity, in which case the host would cease to have any part in the essence of the hostess, who would be susceptible to belonging accidentally, as mistress of the home, to some one or other of the guests. The notion of the mistress of the house reposes upon an essential basis. This essence is therefore subjected to restraint by her actual existence as mistress of the house. And here the sole function of betrayal we see is to lift this restraint. If the essence of the hostess lies in fidelity to the host, this authorizes the host to cause the hostess, essential in the existent mistress of the house, to manifest herself before the eyes of the guest. For the host, in playing host, must accept the risk, and these include the consequences of his wife's strict application of the laws of hospitality and of the fact that she dare not be unmindful of her essence, composed of fidelity to the host, for fear that in the arms of the inactual guest come here to actualize her qua hostess, the mistress of the household exists only traitorously. If the essence of the hostess lay in infidelity, the outcome of the game would be a foregone conclusion, and the host the loser before it starts. But the host wishes to experience the risk of losing and feels that, losing rather than winning in advance, he will, at whatever the cost, grasp the essence of the hostess in the infidelity of the mistress of the home. For to possess the faithless one qua hostess faithfully fulfilling her duties, that is what he is after. Hence, by means of the guest, he wishes to actualize something potential in the mistress of the house, an actual hostess in relation to this guest, an inactual mistress of the house in relation to the host. If the hostess's essence remains thus indeterminate, because to the host it seems that something of the hostess might escape him in the event this essence were nothing but pure fidelity on the part of the mistress of the house, the essence of the host is proposed as an homage of the host's curiosity to the essence of the hostess. Now, this curiosity, as a potentiality of the hospitable soul, can have no proper existence except in that which would look to the hostess, were she naive, like suspicion or jealousy. The host, however, is neither suspicious nor jealous, because he is essentially curious about that very thing which in everyday life would make a master of the house suspicious, jealous, unbearable. Let the guest not be the least uneasy. Above all, let him not suppose he could ever be cause for jealousy or suspicion when there is not even anyone to feel these sentiments. Let the guest understand his role well. Let him then fearlessly excite the host's curiosity by that jealousy and that suspicion, worthy in the masters of the house, but unworthy of a host. The latter enjoins the guest loyally to do his utmost. In this competition, let them surpass each other in subtlety. Let the host put the guest's discretion to the test, and the guest make proof of the host's curiosity. The term generosity has no place in this discussion, since everything is generosity and everything is also greed. But let the guest take all care, lest this jealousy or this suspicion grow to such proportions that no room is left in the host for his curiosity, for it is upon this curiosity that the guest depends for his prestige. If the host's curiosity aspires to actualize itself in the absent cause, how does he hope to convert this absence into presence, unless it be that he awaits the visitation of an angel? Solicited by the host's piety, the angel is capable of concealing himself in the guise of a guest. Is it you, whom the host believes fortuitous? In order that the host's curiosity not degenerate into jealousy or suspicion, it is for you, the guest, to discern the hostess's essence in the mistress of the house, for you to cast her forth from potentiality into existence. Either the hostess remains sheer phantasm, and you a stranger in this house, if you leave to the host the inactualized essence of the hostess, or else you are indeed that angel, and by your presence you give an actuality to the hostess. You shall have full power over her as well as over the host. And so, cherished guest, you cannot help but see that it is in your best interest to fan the host's curiosity to the point where the mistress of the house, driven out of herself, will be completely actualized in an existence which shall be determined by you alone, by you, the guest, and not by the host's curiosity. Whereupon the host shall be the master in his house no more. He shall have carried out his mission. In his turn, he shall have become the guest. Okay. So you can see how disappointing this would be if you were turning to this novel primarily for its erotic benefits. It's very hard work in between the few erotic scenes. Okay. The actualization that the laws of hospitality affects assumes an essential, almost spiritual form, obvious in the heavily theological tone of the laws. We must remember that they are composed by a Catholic theologian, albeit one who has been banned from his post for his predilection for writing perversely erotic fiction. The allegory that frames Octave's elaboration of the laws is an obvious allusion to what is perhaps the most famous religious narrative of hospitality, Abraham's reception of the angels in Genesis chapter 18. The relation between them is essential to the extent that the host is actualized, whose reception of the divine host, the absent cause of his own identity. In this instance, the angels come to announce the transformation of Abraham's merely mortal state into a holy one, to the miraculous birth of his only son, Isaac. But in Genesis, as in Klosowski's scenario, the host's transformation can only be achieved through the actualization of an inactual possibility of his wife, the hostess. In this case, the angels promise to realize the inactual essence of the hostess Sarah by giving the barren woman a child. She is the medium through which the identities of host and guest are joined in an essential relation, and for this reason is often read in Christianity as prefiguring the Annunciation. However, when Octave describes the affect of curiosity as the potentiality of the hospitable soul and calls for it to eclipse the master's jealousy, he seems to be alluding to another important hospitality paradigm as well. In the City of God, Augustine understands Abraham's hospitality as a prefiguration of the new covenant, through which Christ makes possible a community of grace in which many are bound together in one heart, as he puts it. But although the community of shared love may be wholehearted, the precondition of its wholeness is a necessary exclusion, in this case of what he calls private will or personal interest. And this is a quotation from Book 15 of the City of God. Isaac, who was born as a result of a promise, is rightly interpreted as symbolizing the children of grace, who form a community where there is no love of a will that is personal and, we may say, private, but a love that rejoices in a good that is at once shared by all and unchanging, a love that makes one heart out of many, a love that is the wholehearted and harmonious obedience of mutual affection. In Augustine's interpretation of the hospitality bond, the host welcomes the unknown in the hopes that it might not be so unknown after all, that behind the unknown name of the stranger, there might lie hidden an essence that he does know, or at the very least knows how to name, to resume under the inclusive logos of the divine signifier. In Augustine's paradigm, the essential relation between host and guest can be obtained only at the expense of subsuming them into a transcendent community, which neutralizes their particular identities. In Christian theology, Abraham's hospitality becomes a figure for the Holy Trinity and represents the possibility of actualizing a higher identity by seeking communion with the absent cause. In the words of one doctrinal interpretation, quote, the stranger becomes the pretext, the means through which we enter into Eucharistic communion with the Creator. Thus, the stranger acquires a sacred character, unquote. But the result is that individual strangers become less strange, reduced to the status of pretexts for some already familiar manifestation. In many Christian interpretations of hospitality, Christ is present in the host and guest alike and allows for a possible equality by mediating between the different participants who become values of the one Christ through the act of communion. In other words, they enter into relation with one another only to the extent that they actualize the inactual essence of Christ. When Octave writes at the bottom of the first paragraph that what he seeks with the stranger is a relationship of one with oneself, upheld by laws, he seems to advocate a similar reduction to a common measure. However, Klosowski's version of hospitality both alludes to the Christian tradition and departs from it. On the one hand, both the hostess and the guest appear to have Christ-like roles. The hostess is an offering, is the medium through which two distinct entities enter into substantial relation, akin to Christ's Eucharistic status as a gift who is both handed over to strangers and offered in sacrifice. And that's why Christ is called host in the Christian tradition, is it's from the Latin hostia, which means the sacrifice that compensates the anger of the gods. But the guest also serves a similar function, since he enters into the intimacy of the marriage in order to realize something latent within it, and in so doing acquires a quasi-divine status. But against the notion of either personal or communal identity as whole or one, Klosowski makes hospitality synonymous with a conflict or division internal to identity. His three-term relation is less a trinity than a sexualized threesome, where the third term is important not so much as an agent of unification, but as an intruder who introduces a fissure into the reciprocal relation between two people. As a third term heterogeneous to the reversible dyad of host and guest, the hostess both facilitates the relation between them and insists upon its impossibility. She doesn't so much mediate between the host and guest as come between them in two ways, or actually three ways, but I won't go into that. On the one hand, she is suspended between them, stuck in the middle, caught between the arms of the host and the stranger, who, in the blink of an eye, looms up in such a way as to loosen her husband's hold over her. But she also comes between them in the sense that she incites a kind of a rivalry, a contest in which the host and guest meet as opponents in a struggle for prestige. As a result, her role in actualizing the hospitable relation between host and guest depends not only on her status, depends not on her status as a universal value or constant, as in the example of Christ, but upon her inconstancy in the fullest sense of the word. A divine gift, albeit one whose status is qualified by its value as an object of rivalry and even theft, she is no agent of harmonious unity. In the same way, the guest role involves not sharing or unity, but competition, prestige, and the threat of loss. In marked distinction to Augustine's appeal for a hospitable community united in one heart, Klosowski's host invites the guest to do his utmost to incite an emotion resembling jealousy, a very unchristian turn of events. He is called upon to undertake the very delicate operation of introducing a specific division into the bond between husband and wife. If he pulls it off, he will be heralded as an angel. If not, the essences of each different participant will remain unrealized. Later in the novel, Klosowski sums up the genesis and guiding principle of the laws of hospitality when he writes, quote, "In the beginning was betrayal." An originary betrayal is called upon to realize hospitality as a principle of incoherence or disillusion, displacing the word, the Christian logos, as a source of communal coherence. It's very hard to read Klosowski. It's like a tongue twister. Yeah. But the notion that the host's identity can only be actualized through this splitting or division points to yet another field of associations evoked by Oktav's laws, the logic of potlatch, a highly ritualized form of hospitality that also promises to realize or actualize the giver's sacred status through loss or expropriation. The partial surrender of his substance ultimately confirms the mastery and prestige of the host, which grows in direct proportion to the loss or destruction of goods. The more the master gives, the more he has, because his prestations will eventually be reciprocated by others, but also, and most importantly, because his prestige accrues in the act of giving. In the same way, Octava's host augments his prestige by offering his most cherished good up to others. But while his hospitality relation approximates the logic of potlatch, it is also subtly different. For although Oktav proposes to offer up his wife to chance strangers, he neither expects nor gets anything in return. He receives neither monetary compensation nor honor from his guests, who in fact dismiss him as a lecherous old pervert with a libertine wife, nor does he enjoy other wives in exchange for his own. To understand the nuances of Oktav's conception of the gift, we have to appreciate its continuity with theft, or what might even be called a logic of sacred expenditure. For the aim of this prestation is not merely to accrue symbolic prestige by generously bestowing goods, but to effect the forcible erosion or dissolution of the master's personal property. Roberta's hostess is a gift who must in a sense be stolen from the host, who in turn must recognize and accept her theft by a worthy guest. The guest's status as an angel is thus qualified by his role as thief, a possessor as illegitimate as he is fortuitous. The uniting of these two apparently antithetical qualities in the person of the unknown stranger has a long cultural history that harkens back to a context in which the offering of women is celebrated as the foundation of a prestige economy whose stakes cannot be reduced to mere commodification or exchange. And in the longer version of this, I talk at length about Marcel Mauss's study, The Gift. But I cut that out here. Claude Lévi-Strauss showed that the aim of exogamy, above and beyond the cultural objectives of prohibiting incest or guaranteeing the spread of language, is to establish and maintain an economy of prestige in which a family attains its status through the matches it arranges for its daughters, who function as a kind of social currency. The daughters must always marry up, and in principle will always do so as long as the family is on the ascent. If, on the other hand, the family has fallen from favor, the daughters will be unable to marry up, and the family's downward mobility will be sealed. But the paradox is that as a family accrues prestige and advances up the social hierarchy, it becomes harder and harder to find suitable matches for its daughters. This, according to Lévi-Strauss, is what explains the phenomenon so common in legend, in which the most prized virgin in the realm, for example, the princess or the daughter of the ranking chieftain, is unable to be married at all. This is where the function of the guest or outsider as thief comes in and acquires its prestigious or even sacred dimension. For if this prized virgin is barricaded in a tower or consigned to God, it isn't just because there are no worthy suitors in the realm, but because no suitor is good enough for her, according to the laws of social prestige. Hence, she is given to God, either literally removed from the sexual economy by taking religious vows or assuming a sacred function, including blood sacrifice, or given to the one who presents himself either as a god or under the sign of godliness, in other words, the guest. In the guise of the knight-errant or stranger from afar, he wanders the countryside like the gods of old, seeking out chance encounters through which prestige can be established. By solving a riddle, winning a joust, or otherwise establishing his worth, the guest wins the hand of the elite virgin or princess. The function of the interloping stranger is thus to steal as his wife or lady the woman who is too good simply to be given away through available avenues of exchange. Paradoxically, the stranger proves the value of the woman he takes by removing her from circulation, establishing her transcendence of all economies of exchange by introducing a gap into the reciprocity-based economy of social relations. Of course, Klossowski adds a significant twist to this basic paradigm in Robert Sessoir, since it is not the prized damsel or marriageable virgin who is subject to theft by a stranger or God, but rather the master's own wife. For what Octave puts into circulation is not just a prized possession, or even a priceless one, but an inalienable possession, something that by its very nature can belong to no one else. Or as he himself puts it later on in the trilogy, quote, the wife prostituted by the husband is nonetheless still the wife, the husband's inexchangeable good, the priceless good, who shows her worth when the wife surrenders to a lover chosen by her husband. The tension between prestige and loss is even more complicated than it at first appears. It is qualified by a delicate balance between the claims of the host and the claims of the husband, between the faithfulness of the hostess and the fidelity of the mistress of the home, each of which appear to be mutually exclusive. How can the master make the transition to hospitality without simply losing his wife? In other words, how does hospitality avoid simply lapsing into adultery? And even more importantly, why does Octave need to force this limit? What is he trying to accomplish by trying to locate hospitality both within the marriage and in direct opposition to it? This apparent antinomy between the interests of the host and the master of the home seems all the more perplexing when we consider that the two terms are etymologically inseparable. A brief look at this etymology reveals the crisis Klossowski is trying to provoke when he proposes that the host's own wife serve as a hospitable offering. In his seminal study of the Indo-European roots of hospitality, Emile Benveniste identifies two primary roots in the ancient compound hostipets. Hostis, meaning guest or host, and pet or pot, meaning master. The Latin potis, which is the source of the modern potentate, names the master of the home, the one who makes the law in the house. The one who offers hospitality must be the master at home, chez lui. And Benveniste draws some attention to the fact that chez lui, like bei sich in German, designates not only the home, the place where you live, but also the at-homeness of identity. The house in which the master makes the law, but also the fact of residing within an identity itself. For potus identifies not just the master in the sense of an authoritative power, but the one who is eminently himself, the very personification of personal identity. The mastery or power of the potus is thus nothing other than ipseity itself, the chez soi of identity in which the master gathers together and disposes of what is proper to him. The archaic French term Klossowski uses to designate the master of the house, maître de séance, is closely tied to this genealogy, since séance is related not only to the house, or the casa in the Latin, where the master makes the law, but to the chez soi as the at-homeness of ipséity, as self-identity. Both historically and etymologically, the notion of personal identity is already grounded in a very precise idea of personal property, which is also intimately related to the domestic sphere and the sexual relation. In fact, many of the words in this linguistic family apply both to the master and to the husband. The Greek posis, for example, is both a poetic term for the husband and the root of despotes, the master or despot. Despotes and its Latin equivalent dominus represent the extension of domestic authority into the field of social and symbolic power. Both terms designate not only the lord or the head of the clan, but also the possessor, the one who has power over and is able to dispose of his subjects. The master's ability to eminently personify not only his own identity, but that of the group, is upheld by the possession of and power over the human dependents who are defined as his property. The connotations of lord, master, and possessor are intimately bound up in one another, since the master is self-possessed only insofar as he is also possessed of material and human property. So that the ownership of personal property in this etymology actually emerges as the foundation on which it is possible to speak of someone having a personal identity. In archaic practice and in biblical tradition, the host's offering of his own substance to his guest often takes the form of his ability to dispose of those female dependents who make up his personal property and who are equated with the host by virtue of their subordinate dependents. In many biblical narratives, the host fulfills his duty toward the guest by offering up his mistress or unmarried daughters, as though the sacrifice of his chattel represented a surrender of some part of himself. However, this reasoning also implies that there is something heterogeneous about the host's identity as a master equal to himself, since the personal identity he embodies is not self-identical or autonomous, but already a kind of plurality. What then is the property of the host, and who is the host proper? In his rich study of the concept of the person, Marcel Mauss observes that in many clan-based societies, personhood inheres in the ownership of certain ritual objects, which mark the bearer's responsibility for his whole clan. But for this very reason, personhood can also be acquired through inheritance, theft, or murder, which transfers to the usurping party the privative personhood of the last owner. Although woman as property contributes to the master's eminent personification of personal identity, she also undermines the illusion of self-sufficiency and ipséity that the master is supposed to embody by drawing attention to its dependence upon an improper attachment or addition, which remains foreign even in being subordinated and internalized. The hostess attests to the presence of something improper within the host's personal property, a foreign presence internal to the host's eminent personification of identity. Earlier, I drew attention to a paradox internal to the notion of personal identity the host embodies. Although the host is master, is the one who personifies personal and group identity, his identity as host is realized only through the dispossession and surrender of his substance. When Octave exposes his wife to theft, therefore, he isn't just risking the loss of his property, but of his personhood as such. He wants to strain his proprietary claims to the breaking point, even to the point of breaking apart mastery himself, because his status as master of the home stands in the way of his actualization as host. Although Klossowski's interpretation of hospitality is not necessarily unique in making a living woman the object of dispossession, it is nearly unique in proposing that the host's wife occupy this role, and more so for the particular stakes it attaches to this dispossession. In most traditions, the loss incurred when the host's property is expropriated gets recuperated in some way, making the dispossession he experiences merely imminent or temporary. Although the Hebrew Bible contains numerous examples of women being offered up to guests, it is significant that this offer is almost never acted upon. Typically, the host is preserved from the complete loss of his personal property by some form of divine intervention, which either prevents the act from happening in the first place, as in the story of Lot, who offers his virgin daughters as a sacrifice to the Sodomites, or valorizes it after the fact. The dispossession of identity is thus recovered dialectically and becomes the point of departure for a new actualization of identity. The same holds true in the logics of potlatch or sacred theft, where the symbolic prestige of the host grows in direct proportion to the loss of goods or human dependence. In Klossowski's scenario, however, what the host desires is the dispossession of identity itself, and not the eventual dialectical recovery of mastery. His ultimate aim is to become the guest in his own home, to savor the moment of expropriation, at which he is dispossessed not only of his most defining property, but also of the identity that it guarantees. By soliciting the part of the hostess nature that exceeds the master's proprietary hold over her, the guest points to a contradiction internal to the identity of the man who possesses her, a fissure or a split within the principle of personal property that the master embodies. When his wife is surprised by the guest in her quality as mistress of the house and actualized as hostess, the husband's determination as master, that is the one who is eminently equal to himself and capable of symbolically personifying the household, according to Benveniste's definition, is rendered improper and alienated. In short, he is realized as host precisely through the loss of his identity as master. This is the defining logic of Klossowski's laws of hospitality, which in their aporia-like quality strive to maintain the paradox internal to hospitality as a simultaneous dispossession and realization of the host's identity. Although Octave admits, as mentioned earlier, that one cannot at the same time take and not take, be there and not be there, enter a room when one is already in it, this is nonetheless precisely what he proposes to do, by forcing the impossible limit between the fidelity of the hostess and the fidelity of the wife, and between the curiosity of the host and the jealousy of the master. For if Octave's formulation of the laws favors the affect of curiosity over jealousy, it isn't only because jealousy is a less refined emotion. Rather, it is because jealousy is structurally tied to a particular notion of privative identity, in which the integrity of the person is made synonymous with his ability to jealously guard possessions to himself, and thereby maintain the unity or coherence of the personal property of the self. This understanding of jealousy is directly related to the curiosity the host hopes to experience. Curiosity, as the potentiality of the hospitable soul, is the emotion that corresponds to the erosion of privative personhood. This is why the host awaits the stranger not merely as a thief, but as a liberator he calls upon to free him from the privative constraints of his identity. But the notion of jealousy as a principle of privative identity also has a theological source. In the first commandment of the Decalogue, God's jealousy is invoked as the conditioning tenet of monotheism. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, and thou shalt have no others before me. Elsewhere, I've argued that in the logic of the Hebrew Bible, hospitality after Exodus is increasingly bound up in the problem of idolatry, or what the metaphor of Israel's marriage to God figures as the wife's adulterous welcoming of strangers in the place of her husband. But this antinomy between hospitality and monotheism suggests that what the hostess betrays is not only a bond of allegiance, but a principle of unity. God's jealousy is the index of his sublime singularity, the oneness on which the doctrine of monotheism is based. But this betrayal has important implications not just for God, but for the human subject whose personhood is modeled on this integral oneness. The Decalogue upholds the sanctity of individual personhood by giving it jealous dominion over the things it possesses, including the wife, which are coextensive with their possessor and thus off-limits to the covetous neighbor or stranger. In his 1970 essay, Protas et Apodos, Klossowski describes the importance of the wife's betrayal through a gloss of the 10th commandment of the Decalogue, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. And this is a short quotation I put at the bottom of the second page of your handout there. The interdiction affirms a subject possessed of a person who is here defined as an inalienable object. But to the extent that this object acts, it negatively reveals itself to have the quality of a subject, insofar as it consented to the possession of the first possessor. It then loses the subjective quality once again by substituting someone else for the first possessing subject. In this way, the interdiction institutes a moral agency of the object, a moi de l'objet, which only possesses this intrinsic quality to the extent that it is legitimately possessed, and that, according to the interdiction, expropriates itself of that moral quality by expropriating its legitimate proprietor in favor of a fortuitous and illegitimate possessor. What is curious about this citation is that Klossowski references the commandment concerning the neighbor's goods and not the more obvious choice, the commandment against idolatry. adultery. Perhaps this is because the first implies an essential link between the thing and its proprietor, while the second implies the independent agency of a subject who is linked to her spouse in a legal or accidental way, to use Klosowski's term. In the logic of monogamous marriage, the husband possesses his wife in an exclusive, inalienable way. However, her susceptibility to appropriation by an illegitimate possessor proves that he can never possess her completely. She is part of the husband's property only to the extent that she is improper to it, since the wife as object possesses a moral agency that gives her the negative quality of a subject. A subject, that is, the mistress of the home, can commit adultery, but an object, i.e. the inactual essence of the hostess as a thing or as a given offering, can do much more. It can actually expropriate its possessor. Whereas Israel's adultery destroys her marriage, but doesn't contaminate or dissolve the oneness of her divine husband, Robert's hospitality actually splinters her husband's oneness, since as a possessed thing, she is implicated in his subjectivity. This is why the tension between betrayal and fidelity is so important to Oktav's formulation of the laws. For, as he says, if the essence of the hostess lay in infidelity, the outcome of the game would be a foregone conclusion, and the host the loser before it starts. It is not simple infidelity he wants to experience, or what we might call adultery, but rather the fidelity of the hostess within the infidelity of the mistress of the home. Or, as he puts it, to possess the faithless one qua hostess, faithfully fulfilling her duties, that is what the host is after. If Robert is given to the guest simply as the mistress of the house and not as hostess, the hospitality act is compromised at the outset. If Octave and Robert break through the privative constraints of the master and mistress of the home and yet fail to find hospitality on the other side, this transgression will have been for naught. The wife would be no more than an adulteress, and the husband would experience nothing more than the wounded narcissism of the cuckold. The jealousy of the master of the house would preclude his curiosity, preventing the inactual essence of the host from manifesting itself. And as a result, the expropriation the host seeks would be impossible. For only the hostess can let the stranger in by admitting the guest into the intimacy of the exclusive marriage and thereby allowing estrangement to rupture the master's privative self-identity. In privileging this dissolution of identity over the principle of coherence it betrays, Klosowski also revalues the meaning of the hostess's idolatry, making it the basis of a new ethics. Robert's hospitality dissolves monotheist integrity, giving rise to a divinity that is multiple, fragmented, and fortuitous. Her betrayal facilitates the essential actualization of the hospitality event, since it allows her to idolatrously surrender herself to the divinity of a chance stranger, and thereby actualize him as guest. Within the context of the trilogy, Robert's disbelief and betrayal of this jealous oneness is important on a number of different levels. She is an atheist of Protestant origin who finds her husband's incessant attempts to offer a theological account of her soul thoroughly absurd. One of the holdovers from her Protestant upbringing is her refusal to accept the doctrine of divine mediation, so central to Octave's scholastic Catholicism. But her disbelief is not restricted to her lack of religious faith, which is little more than a foil. More fundamentally, her disbelief is a function of woman's inherent infidelity or inadequation to the divine image and the unanchoring of femininity with regard to the signifier. Women, Robert suggests, are natural atheists. Their atheism indexes an inherently unbelieving nature, incapable of being equated with or made in the image of the divine person. But paradoxically, it is Robert's atheism that makes her susceptible to the angelic intervention of the guest, the illegitimate and fortuitous possessor who actualizes the hostess through a substantial appropriation. Klosowski develops the implications of Robert's atheism in two different ways. First, through a dense argument derived from scholastic theology, which I will fortunately spare you, Moses, in which Octave proves Robert's susceptibility to corporal expropriation. And second, through an implicit allusion to Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophical critique of the Judeo-Christian origins of personhood. In the extended theological dialogue that makes up the body of Robert's Histoire, Octave suggests that the rupturing of the private designations of the master and mistress of the home is possible only through the loss of the incommunicability of souls, the theological principle according to which an individual's being remains attributable only to itself and which constitutes identity as such. According to this principle, the incommunicability of the person can only be suspended in death, which separates body and soul and facilitates the soul's reassociation with another discrete body. Sorry, I'm really bludgeoning you with this. But in Robert's case, Octave theorizes that disbelief has suspended her incommunicable character. As a result, the integrity of her person can no longer be guaranteed. The language of accidental and substantial unions is drawn from the work of Thomas Aquinas, who derives a theological proof for the soul's essential unity with the body from the doctrine of incarnation. According to Aquinas, the soul is able to unite substantially to the body and retain its being even after the body's dissolution, because the integrity of body and soul is upheld by God. Taking this Aquinian reasoning as his point of departure, Octave uses a syllogistic composite of scholastic reasoning to demonstrate that the terms of the theological argument for discrete personhood actually provide justification for the dissolution of the person in those cases where the subject in question does not adhere to, and therefore cohere through, a belief in the transcendental unity of the divine person. When Robert declares that a woman's body is her soul, her statement both references Aquinas' argument and at the same time suggests how it might be overturned. Her disbelief means her soul and her body are only accidentally united, making her susceptible to corporal expropriation at the hands of another. In other words, the dissolution of the soul affects the dissolution of the body. But this theological argument concerning privative personhood is further qualified by Klossowski's understanding of Nietzsche's death of God and his philosophy of the eternal return. I might just mention as a biographical note that Klossowski was himself, novice? Who was training for the priesthood and was studying scholastic theology at the Institut Catholique in Paris when he was sort of rescued by his reading of Nietzsche. In The Will to Power, Nietzsche writes, "Nihilism stands at the door. Whence comes this uncanniest of all guests? As the uncanniest of all guests, nihilism is internal to Christian individualism as its logical limit. To Nietzsche, Christianity is the dominant expression of European nihilism, but he also envisions its abolition through what he calls the ultimate nihilism, the logic of the eternal return, which is also the most uncanny of all guests. Uncanny, first of all, to Christian nihilism itself, whose cult of monotheism and the positive principle of identity that depends upon it precludes any sense of the other, or for that matter of the self, as an unknown. In Nietzsche's wake, the hospitality relation paradoxically aligns itself once again with the concerns of ancient divine hospitality, maintaining an aporetic relation to the unknown in other than compensatory salvational modes. Like Klossowski's chance stranger, whose seizure of the master's personal property is both illegitimate and fortuitous, the eternal return as the uncanniest of guests dissolves its host in a way that is both destructive and liberating. If the monotheist God reifies not only subjective boundaries, but also the unknown itself, then the death of God allows the unknown to manifest itself in other forms. But although Nietzsche sees the murder of God as essential to this possibility, he also warns that even after God, we run the risk of preserving or instituting principles that will not transvalue nihilistic Christian values, but instead create new and equally insidious ones. For the transvaluation of all values to be complete, he argues, we must overcome not only the monotheist understanding of God, but also the positive idea of personal identity that depends upon it. This argument may explain why Klossowski makes his protagonist a Christian theologian, for isn't all of Western culture Christian in this regard, that is, in the sense of subscribing to an ontic view of personhood? In the postscript to The Laws of Hospitality, Klossowski develops the implication of Nietzsche's death of God within the theological argument for discrete personhood by demonstrating that the formal identity of the I, or the self, is necessarily submitted to a divine order, a single God that conditions its possibility. Any identity, and this is quoting from the postscript, any identity rests solely upon the knowledge of a thinker outside of ourselves, if we grant that there is an inside and an outside, who agrees from the outside to think us as such. If it is God on the inside as well as on the outside, in the sense of absolute coherence, then our identity is pure grace. If it is the ambient world, where everything begins and ends with designation, then our identity is merely a grammatical joke. Although we tend to think of personhood as an innate ontic property, Nietzsche and Klossowski both emphasize its often unacknowledged grounding in Christian theology. For example, St. Paul famously reconceives personhood as a universal attribute by identifying it with baptism in Christ. quote, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one person through Christ Jesus." But although this verse seems to posit the inalienability of personhood, it actually makes it contingent upon playing host to the oneness of Christ's person, which bestows a proper personhood by dwelling in one's heart. This is no doubt what Nietzsche has in mind when his Zarathustra declares that human beings are merely wearing the mask of the monotheist God, which gives the illusion of a coherent private of self. As is well known, the Roman notion of the person, the persona, was derived from the idea of the mask, and specifically the wax image of the dead ancestor. The legal concept of the person designated the one who possessed this mask, whether legitimately or not. Although Roman law gradually came to associate the concept of the persona with the true nature of the individual, its original identification with the mask also gave rise to another conception of the persona as a simulated, artificial, or even duplicitous mask of the self. Despite the best efforts of the Church Fathers, the survival of this genealogy continued to hint at the uncomfortable proximity between ontological personhood and its repudiated siblings, the simulacrum or theatrical personage. In his 1950 essay, Nietzsche, Polytheism and Parody, Klosowski argues that if God is the only possible guarantor of the identity of the I and of its substantial base, bodily integrity, then the death of God dissolves the grammatical fiction of the self, opening the way for a new understanding of subjectivity as divided, multiple, dissolute, and irresponsible. When the monotheist mask of God is stripped away, the artificial integrity of the self gives way to the multiplicity of the ego. In this sense, Klosowski makes clear that the declaration, "God is dead," is not so much a call to atheism as the liberation of a polytheism that would abolish the privative constraints of the self. Paradoxically, the death of the monotheist God also results for Nietzsche in a liberation of the divine. In Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he writes, "Is not precisely this godliness that there are gods but no God?" When God dies, the ego becomes divine, but as dissolved, as conditioned not by the integrity of the one God, but by the disintegration of Dionysus, God of dismemberment and disindividuation. Klosowski adapts Nietzsche's discovery to the logic of hospitality, in which the dissolution of the self is celebrated as a divine act. After the death of the eternal witness, who alone was capable of guaranteeing the identity of the self, divinity resides in a new kind of witness, the guest who takes it upon himself to liberate the master from his privative identity. As a liberator from individuation, the guest partakes of the particular divinity of Dionysus, the sacred guest who very literally dispossesses or even dismembers his host. But while Klosowski's conception of hospitality is indebted to Nietzsche, it does not simply duplicate or enact his work, but rather develops this thought in a very particular direction. To Nietzsche's discovery of the liberating potential of the Dionysian guest, he adds an insistence on the privileged role of the feminine in effecting this dissolution. As a Catholic who doesn't acknowledge either the death of God or the dissolution of identity that results from it, Octave can only experience this dissolution secondarily through its effect on Robert. Octave feels that he is too constrained by his identity, while Robert is too little bound by hers. The dissociation from the divine foundations of what Klosowski calls the grammatical fiction of the I is more pronounced in her case, intensified by the already unanchored relation between femininity and the signifier. In their ambivalent relation to legal rights, women have always challenged the ontic view of personhood with evidence of its non-universality. Even as Roman law began to identify the persona with the true nature of the individual, it continued to withhold personhood from those who did not own property, most notably women and slaves. As Renata Salesel has argued, woman is a symptom of the rights of man. She reminds us that the mask of unified personhood has always fit some subjects much better than others. In Klosowski's trilogy, the marginal position accorded to femininity by traditional understandings of the subject appears as a singular force. It recalls the function of religion in the particular sense in which Emmanuel Levinas understands the term, the possible surplus in a society of equals. But at the same time, the feminine embodies an alterity that has no transcendent dimension but is firmly materialist. For although the feminine approximates the divine in its excessive quality, it is in part because of its ambivalent relationship to the positive principle of personal identity that the monotheist God imparts. We see its importance in what Klosowski calls the moi de l'objet, the paradoxical agency that the object, in this case the hostess, assumes within the subject who possesses it. By drawing attention to the relationship between the master's eminent personification of personal identity and his jealous identification with his possessions, the hostess insists upon the heteronomous underpinnings of the personal property of the self. Against the positive idea of personal identity, whose privative quality is guaranteed by the monotheist understanding of God as a unified oneness, Klossowski's vision of hospitality affirms the division and multiplicity internal to the subject in the form of a multiple cogito, a polytheist subjectivity that would abolish the privative constraints of the self. In the postscript to the Laws of Hospitality, he develops this notion through the idea of a divided subject, or what Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari call the cogito à deux, a cogito for whom the act of thought does not guarantee its being as a consistent subject, but rather calls it into question by suggesting that others may be thinking in me. As Klossowski writes in the postscript to the Laws, the word establishes the duration of the thinking subject through the fiction of the personal pronoun as the source or home of judgment, in order that thought as such always returns to one point among others. But does it always return to it? At each word, I have to wonder whether it is I who am thinking, or whether others are thinking in me or for me, or thinking me, or even thinking before I've really thought myself what they're thinking, whether thought is a property, an appropriation, or the expropriation of thought. The possibility that others might be thinking in me challenges the notion that there is a thinker outside of me, the word or God, who is conditioning my ego as an integral unity. If God is for Descartes the guarantor of the cogito, then the death of God, his failure to support the fiction of the personal pronoun as the source or home of judgment, results in the home of thought being susceptible to occupation by strangers, most notably the hostess. For as the moi de l'objet, or thing, the hostess is the one who thinks in the host insofar as he is not all, revealing the uncanny dispossession of the home of judgment by a foreign object. And this is my final paragraph. But for Klossowski, the implications of this experience of dispossession or expropriation are not at all negative, since the role of the hostess suggests how the identity of the post-Nietzschean subject might be understood as other than a principle of self-adequation. It models an ethical position that is not limited to the female sex, but that consists in an excessive relation to the signifier. Although Nietzsche associates Dionysus with the dissolution of the ego that is affirmatively revalued as divine, and that opposes itself to the transcendental redemption of the self embodied by Christ, he also asserts that after God, mankind must assume an authentically feminine attitude in welcoming Dionysus. He associates it with the figure of Ariadne as the one who welcomes the transfiguring advent of the divine guest. Klossowski hints at something similar into the preface to his trilogy when he writes that, for 10 years now I have lived, or believe I have lived, under the sign of the hostess. To live under the sign of the hostess is, as Octave puts it in the last line of his Laws, to become the guest in one's own home, to become this foreign thing, the spot of alterity or estrangement, within the chez-soi of identity. Thank you. Okay. I mean, I apologize for it was a very long and torturous reading. You realize the sadism of Klossowski is really situated at another than thematic level. It's very dense. Any questions?
Lots of questions and thank you for the very, very rich presentation. You mentioned the biblical parable, as it were, of Sodom, which for me is a real Klossowskian twist on hospitality, since Lot is not only ready to offer his daughters, but ends up having sex with them. After the destruction of Sodom. As if there was always somehow in the, let's say, climax of hospitality, something that periodically returned to endogamy, since Lot wants to save the angels from the Sodomites by offering his unmarried daughters. As you said, that doesn't happen, but in the end, he leaves the city, his wife disappears, the crucial moment, and he ends up sleeping with his daughters in two caves and so on. Incest is reestablished in a way, a little like what seems to me, and this is my question, it's a concept I've never really understood in Klosowski that you mentioned once or twice, that of parody.
Mm.
And the link, let's say, between the Nietzschean side of parody and the parody of the law that, let's say, when we read the beginning,
mm-hmm.
it looks like a parody somehow,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it's not, but
mm-hmm.
what kind of parody could that be?
Mm-hmm.
Or a parody, is it just a parody of the Christian idea of consubstantiality that would be achieved through the substance of the wife shared by two men?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you situate? How do you somehow situate parody here? See what I mean?
Yeah.
Parody and perversion. Right,
yeah. Yeah, well, those are three really great questions. I mean, maybe I'll respond to the last one first. With the question of parody, I hadn't actually thought of it so much in the second way that you mentioned in relation to perversion, although one can make that connection, I think, very much so. On the one hand, Klosowski's reading of the importance of parody through Nietzsche has to do precisely with the falling away of the mask in the sense of the... When he says that human beings are wearing the mask of God, right, he refers to the notion of the coherent self as one that appears to be coherent only because man is sort of modeling himself in the image of a God that he creates. But the corollary of that is that once that mask is torn away, what emerges is not the true self, right, the sort of essential self, but rather an endless profusion of masks. Right, so whence the role of Dionysus as the patron of theater and comedy, right, as the god of mask in that sense as well. So that it's really the simulacrum or the mask or the personage that he upholds against the person. In terms of the more perverse reading of that, when you said at the beginning it reads like a parody, you mean in the beginning of the text of the laws of hospitality? Yeah.
Invites a stranger in all the puns,
right,
which I think are audible in English,
mm-hmm.
are maybe more obvious in French.
Right.
When mm-hmm. you transform maître de séance to maîtresse
mm-hmm.
de séance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have when you were right, mistress de séance,
mm-hmm.
the wife becomes a lover, a mistress.
Right, yes.
That element that, in a way, pretends to be a law, which is not exactly like the way Sade, Marquis de Sade,
mm-hmm.
perverts the Republican institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But here there is something that is a little more twisted in
right.
the logic, which I think could be linked, mm-hmm. I don't know, exactly with that Nietzschean sense of parody.
Right, yes. Yes, I think absolutely, because a thing that is not often understood about Klosowski, I think, is that he's read in a sort of unironic way as being Sadean. Right, and of course he's a very great critic of the logic of Sade, precisely. I mean, it's foolish to read him in that way, because what he perceives in Sade, already long before Lacan, though I think it's more often credited to Lacan, actually, is the way in which Sade, sort of on the one hand, mounts this political critique of the signifier, say, in the piece called Français encore en effort, si vous voulez être révolutionnaire, Frenchman yet another effort if you want to be truly Republican, right, where he says to the French people, it is not enough to behead the king, right, until you have uprooted the law itself. You have not really affected the revolution. So that radical side of Sade's work that is really appreciated as political philosophy, I think, in France. And Klosowski really comes along to show that dimension of Sade as the critic of the law is then lost in the sort of second part of that movement, where Sade institutes the universal law of jouissance, right, or the droit de jouir de tous, right, which tears down the law only to erect something new in its place, whether that's his exaltation of nature, right, as sort of a law beyond all laws, or whether it's his understanding of human subjects themselves, who go from the sort of limiting quality of being represented by the law to being simply indifferently represented as objects or as commodities of exchange. So that Klosowski is very much sort of playing with that model in his fiction, where he seems to propose these very Sadean scenarios, but at the same time always wants to insist, I'm not just giving away my wife in exchange for others, right? What I am offering you is the inexchangeable, right? So that there's always a kind of an impossibility to that gesture. So I think that Klossowski always wants to insist upon a contradiction internal to the law, which is why he's such a great thinker of the Bible, really. I mean, although he rarely comments the Bible directly, I think his entire work is really a commentary of the Hebrew Bible to some extent. So that he's much more interested in showing that contradiction internal to the law as opposed to doing away with the law altogether in the mode of a transgression. You mentioned two other things I thought were very interesting as well. The question of the forcing of endogamy in Lot, which I had never thought about in that way, but it is very interesting because, as you know, Lacan's reading of the sixth commandment about not coveting the neighbor's wife, right, is that we see in the neighbor's wife as the interdicted object, the function of dusting, right, or the maternal object, the forbidden object of incest. So that what the law is basically telling us is there is always one woman you may not have because this is the neighbor's thing, right? And the neighbor's thing is, of course, the woman who is interdicted under the law of incest, whether that's the sister or the mother. So that there is a kind of a forcing of that law, which is implied in the hospitality as well. Yes, was there anything else, or did, yeah, no doubt, yeah, thank you, very interesting. Yeah, great.
I actually just wanted you to clarify, I mean, to talk, maybe to piggyback on Michelle's question mm-hmm. about the nature of perversion, because mm-hmm. I was so interested by the line where you're talking about the question of the agency of the object, mm-hmm. and really, I'm not sure that anyone knows about the agency of the object better than the pervert. Mm-hmm. In part because the pervert knows that there is really no object at all, mm-hmm. but also because the pervert has the unique capacity to put him or herself in the place of an object. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, to what degree do you see Klossowski's logic and the laws of hospitality transcending that logic of perversion, or are they still contingent upon it?
Sorry, transcending
the logic of perversion, which is still a Assadian logic in a certain way, mm-hmm. it still returns us. I mean, the pervert can rail against the law all he wants, but mm-hmm. inevitably he reinstalls it
right.
in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you get out of that complex. Mm-hmm. I think obviously your whole paper is in some ways about that, but mm-hmm. maybe within the logic of perversion, mm-hmm. how the logic itself is undone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what Klossowski really shows is that the only pervert who really takes it to the encore en effort is Nietzsche. And that in a way it's in Nietzsche that you have to seek the achievement of what is most interesting in Sade. That Sade failed where Nietzsche introduces the problem of the transvaluation of values. That is not just the sort of revolutionary reinstatement of one new system in the place of the one that has been torn down, but a reexamination of the way in which the law is grounded, of a way in which the notion of economy is grounded. So I would tend to see Klossowski as not a pervert. Actually, I think that's an incorrect designation. But I think that he appeals very much to that kind of logic as a way of staging the radicality of Nietzsche's thought in this kind of unexpected domain. And in fact, one of the things that I'm interested in now, which I haven't really been able to write up yet, is thinking about Nietzsche precisely in the psychoanalytic sense, not as an object of psychoanalysis, but as someone who has a thought the nature of which is psychoanalytic. Say that in the privilege that Nietzsche places on the figure of Dionysus, right, as precisely a dismembered self, I see something very much like what Lacan calls the corps morcelé, right, or the body, say, as opposed to the organism, the body constructed by the fantasy, but a body that is very much a castrated body, okay, and not in the sense of sod, a body that has thrown off sort of the yoke of castration. So I think the thought is very rich there. Klossowski is, you know, for me, someone in whom, you know, most of 20th century French thought really comes to fruition, you know, in a way that I think is not very well appreciated. I mean, you get a sense of the incredible complexity and difficulty of his prose, which is very difficult to read in French. I think he's almost one of the most difficult authors to read, liberally peppered with German and Latin as well. But I think that his decision to work out these problems in the erotic field is very, very interesting in that way. And it's something that you don't entirely see happening in the work of Nietzsche, although Nietzsche certainly points to it. I mean, Nietzsche is, among other things, a great thinker of the body, and not of the material body or the organism, as he's often understood to be referring to, but precisely this other body, I think. Yeah?
You mentioned Mauss, and also, of course, I've been asking me feel like it was worth going back to ask again, but there's a passage in Mauss where he speculates on the idea that it could be the case that the whole invention of an exchange-based logic of exchange, wait, that doesn't make any sense, a non-potlatch-oriented exchange mechanism that actually is based on the profit mechanism as opposed to destructiveness of wealth. Is predicated on the moment when sacrifice became habitual enough so that at a certain point someone began to demand of the sacrifice that it would reproduce. And it seems to me that this whole mechanism then that we're describing here is a way of trying to, and a lot of the ways that you formulated the question of temporality and so forth seem to me to be like the use of a elaborate mechanism to describe how that moment itself could be reversed. And it's just an idea that I thought of.
Sorry, of how what could be reversed?
The moment, okay, so if Mauss tells us that the moment when demand can be instituted in sacrifice is the moment when we, in other words, the whole model of, like, me selling my car to Jean Michel is based on supposedly the moment when someone sacrificing said, I'm going to not anticipate God of his free will giving to me, but rather demand on the basis of my sacrifice.
So that it's already kind of the institution of economy.
Exactly. So that, like, the restricted economy, I suppose it is, that would be initiated with this strange moment in just speculatively on Mauss's part. But it seems to me that what we see in this, then, and a lot of the things you point to that we don't really brag about having done, show how, like, the whole Bourdieu system where there's no way to get out of symbolic capital is undone in this moment. And in a way, like what I'm trying to suggest is that, you know, on that level, this Mauss moment could be seen as like the obverse, a moment where perhaps the whole process that's in the laws of hospitality is accomplished in reverse, going from the general economy of expenditure to the restricted economy in the opposite direction.
It's just an idea.
I wonder if that seemed plausible or
interesting. Yeah, I think in some ways those the different possibilities that you mention are possibilities that Klossowski himself explores in a lot of his work. You know, both in the mode that, say, that's a frequent accusation made against Klossowski, is that this is sort of a bourgeois exchange economy, kind of the ice storm, like wife swapping at the dinner party sort of thing. And Klossowski loves to take up that kind of charge, which I think is implicit in, say, Derrida's critique of Mauss, right, where Derrida is going to insist upon the fact that we really can't speak of a gift that would be other than economy, right, because already to appreciate the gift you have received is, in a sense, to pay back, right, already to feel good about having given the gift is essentially to be compensated for it. And I think that's very true, but I think that something else is at stake in Mauss's reading of the gift, which I see Klossowski as drawing upon. I don't know whether it's literally true that he was drawing upon. I assume that he knew Mauss's work very well, as they were both members of the Collège de Sociologie together. I think that he's really the continuation of Mauss, you know, in a weird and sort of dizzying way. You know, and I think that he develops a side of Mauss's work that is not often talked about, which is this extraordinary line where Mauss says that gift-giving affects an intermingling of essences, a transferential exchange in which things are mingled with souls and souls with things, which is really quite amazing. And actually, I encountered a line of Lacan's the other day, which I had never noticed before, from La Chose Freudienne, where he highlights precisely that. It's very interesting. You know, and he says what Marcel Mauss tells us about is that culture is born in the moment in which you have an immixture of things with persons. And I think that Klossowski is really trying to develop that, too, and say that, in some sense, our way of thinking about economy, or even our way of thinking about expenditure, is not adequate to thinking about the way that economy is invested within the human subject, you know, where we have to really speak of the object that is internal to subjectivity and what it would mean to exchange that object, which is really the problem that he poses here. You can't give away your wife because your wife is you, right? Who is the I that would then be giving it, you know, once that wife is given away? So the very possibility of exchange breaks down at that moment. So I'm not sure how well that addresses your question, but just to say that, you know, I think that whole posing of the problem is very much complicated in Klossowski's work. Okay. And in La Monnaie Vivante as well, which I mentioned when we were speaking earlier, which is just an incredibly dense and difficult book, but that it really tries to explore these problems in relation to Marx as well. Yes.
Very interesting, actually, fascinating. I don't think it's a shame that Zarathustra didn't have a wife. Someone that could really make this link.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what strikes me as interesting is you were saying about Nietzsche, you know, and you know, psychoanalysis. And the relation between Nietzsche, you know, Wagner and closing Wagner is bizarre and almost close. Like something. Nietzsche was like,
I'm just writing this down and giving me ideas.
You know, breaking, you know, the break that's put around things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're all accusing him of excessive masturbation.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's
fascinating.
Yeah. Yes, it's very fascinating. No, I'm interested that you mentioned that because Cosimo was the person who Nietzsche wrote to as Ariadne. And to whom he signed his letters, Dionysus, right? So it is very interesting. I don't know what I could say about it in particular. I mean, the whole question of Nietzsche's relation with women is obviously, you know, one wants to really think about it in this way because it's not only Zarathustra didn't have a wife after all. I mean, you know, Nietzsche himself was not entirely sure that he had ever had sex, right? I mean, the sacerdotacy is supposed to have contracted syphilis, like may or may not ever have happened. I mean, he was potentially celibate. Another reference that I've not worked on yet, but that I think would be interesting here, is Goethe's The Elective Affinities, you know, that, which is very interesting kind of problem of hospitality also between two couples, in which there's a sort of complex exchanging of the partners, and which also involves a number of other Klosowskian motifs, like the tableau vivant and sort of elaborate staging of these people, but I haven't really had a chance to think about that in more detail. But thank you for the reference. Yes?
Since you're mentioning this, just a very, very silly, basic question about, you spared us, and I thank you, the reproductions of Krasovsky's drawings, and I don't know why so many people find them fantastic, and I think they are really pretty poor. what distinguishes them is that you can recognize in Robert Krasovsky's wife.
Oh, yes.
So,
yes.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, for those who have not seen Klosowski's work, I might mention, by the way, for those who are unfamiliar with his story, that he's the brother of Baltus, right, who I see as really having ripped off all of his material. I mean, the themes of Baltus's painting are Klosowski's themes, but very much better executed than in Klosowski's own work, it's true. But his work deals with a number of the erotic scenarios that are developed in this book, which I didn't explain in detail, which essentially involve this woman, Robert, who is herself modeled on Klosowski's own wife, Denise, who fits this description rather well, of her sort of running around Paris, completing her duties as a high-ranking political official, and for example, being sort of trapped by two schoolboys in a passageway who proceed to administer oral sex, right, or being tied up to parallel bars by a phantom, or being raped in her bath. Right. So there are these kind of exorbitant erotic scenarios which always stage this moment at which Robert, as this kind of Kantian figure of the Enlightenment, this emancipated woman, sort of surrenders in spite of herself to this erotic temptation. But one of the ways that he deals with this is through this gesture that he calls the visual solecism. By which he means, for example, a gesture of the hand that appears to be pushing away the assailant, but at the same time might be interpreted as welcoming the assailant, right? So that he's very interested in, say, Augustine's reading of the rape of Lucretia, right? How can we interpret what was actually Lucretia's will at the moment that she was raping? Did she, in fact, surrender to her erotic desire, and was this why she killed herself? Did she kill herself to protect herself, and so on? So he's very interested in the way that the body kind of betrays the intellect by these small signs. So, I mean, I think that's really the interest of his painting, or drawing, really, they're really colored pencil drawings, is the way that he tries to explore that problem. Diana and Actaeon is his other obsessive theme. But I'm sorry, there was another part to the question as well.
No,
that the,
no,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, and the graphical element, and
Oh, of the fact that they're based on his wife as well. Yeah, well, he actually talks in the first novel of this trilogy extensively about the problem of painting, because this character, Otav, is a collector of works by an imaginary painter, Frédéric Tonnerre, who is a painter very much in the mode of Klossowski, right, who paints these same paintings. So he speaks himself about the way in which the painting is the privileged medium for the laws of hospitality, that in fact the painter is able to realize there what he's never been able to realize in a fully effective manner with his own wife, where, say, the painting both offers us the woman and at the same time makes her inaccessible, both fully reveals her to the gaze and at the same time withholds her in this sort of fundamental way. So that there you see very successfully deployed what in reality can never be affected in the Hospitality Act, because it does have this sort of impossible or aporia-like structure. Right, that as soon as the stranger is actually taken, Robert, it's no longer hospitality, but the moment has been lost. I mean, certainly his use of his own wife is interesting there. Yeah. Yes, he actually photographed her in these kind of pornographic poses until she was about 65 years old. But poor woman, you know, so they're sort of spilling out of corsets and so on. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.